I just want to take a special moment, even though he's not our committee counsel for these hearings today, to recognize the fresh haircut of Mr. Taylor, but also, more importantly, committee members, today Mr. Taylor celebrates his 55th birthday. So let's give a hand to Bill. Squealed. Happy double nickel to you, Bill, and best birthday wishes to you. And we appreciate all your support, and mostly just wanted to embarrass you publicly in front of everybody and on TV.
I look forward to the next 15 years.
To the next 55.
To the next 55, right. Okay, thank you very much. Hope you don't mind our bit of revelry here. We have to take it where we can find it. We're going to start today, colleagues, with moving into our second day of hearings on the medical liability issues, and we're going to start this afternoon with an opening presentation by Mick Alexander, who is president for the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association. Welcome, Mick.
Thank you, and I'd like to bring up Captain.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'm going to be very, very brief at this point in time, and hopefully I'll have some things to add at the end. I'm Mick Alexander. I'm a local attorney. I've been here in Salem for 27 and a half years. I'm also the current president of the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association. I also had the privilege to serve on the governor's task force this last summer that looked into this issue of medical liability crisis, I guess, as it was characterized. I was struck during the course of the task force, really, at how much was talked about statistics and rates and percentages and increases, and I really think not enough about people. And so I was pleased yesterday when the doctors really wanted to put a face on this problem, and the doctors who testified, I think, gave some compelling testimony. And that's why I think from the other side there is an issue about the people who are victims of medical negligence, and Kathy Brooks and Jessica Howard are here to tell you their stories. And Kathy, why don't you go ahead and tell the committee.
I'm Kathy Brooks, and this is my son, Jerry. And you can be a little loud, so hopefully you'll be pretty good during this. I'm here today on behalf of Jerry because he can't really give a voice to to talk about medical malpractice. I hope that our story can help you look beyond the facts and the figures and look at the people who have suffered from medical malpractice. Jerry was born in August of 1997. Our doctor was going on vacation, so she scheduled me for an induction. I was on heavy medication for over 30 hours. After 30 hours, I asked the doctor in the hospital for a cesarean. They both refused, saying that insurance didn't cover that. I appealed to the hospital board, but they said no as well. Why did they say no? We'll never know, because their hospital inquiry into this was, by law, kept silent. I repeatedly asked for a cesarean in the following hours, but the doctor and the hospital representatives continued to refuse. As the hours went on, my son's resistance to the constant contractions weakened, and his heart finally stopped. The nurse who was on duty wasn't looking at the monitor, and my doctor had gone home to sleep. She was tired after all those hours. She told my husband how smoothly things were going and that he should go home and take a rest too, so my husband wasn't there either. The doctor neglected to look at the monitors before she left. And my son's oxygen was cut off for over 15 minutes until someone glanced at the monitor and realized what was happening. There was no one around to perform an emergency cesarean. As they waited for my doctor to get out of bed to come help the baby, another doctor happened to walk in. She was grabbed into the operating room, given a scalpel, and told to get the baby out. She did. Since they were waiting for my doctor to arrive, though, I hadn't been given anesthesia yet. The doctor just plunged in the knife and took out my baby, who was so beautiful, but he wasn't breathing at all. Thankfully, I passed out and didn't see my husband returning to see doctors trying to save my life and see our beautiful baby not breathing. I missed the priest coming in to give him both baptism and last rites. The hospital where I delivered didn't have any preparations for this kind of emergency, and I had to transport him to another hospital. The doctors called from the other hospital within a few hours, telling us to prepare for the worst. And thank God Jerry lived, and he's with us now. But we were told the next day that he was severely brain damaged, that he'd never walk or talk. He'd never say, Mommy, or I love you, or even that his tummy hurts, or even that he's glad to be with us today. Finally, we talked to a lot of doctors at the hospital, and they couldn't tell us what had happened with Jerry. They just knew what the prognosis was going to be. We asked doctor after doctor as they performed lots and lots of tests, and no one was to tell us anything. And finally, a very kind doctor who was treating Jerry took us aside and told us he had reviewed what had happened, and he suggested we see an attorney. Up to that time, it really hadn't crossed our minds to think of in those terms, but we realized that no one at the hospital was prepared to help Jerry except us. We did go to an attorney who was very kind and helpful. We had a conversation and then backed off for several months, hoping Jerry would get better, but he didn't, and we realized that he'd need care for the rest of his life. Our case was very complicated. With a birth accident, every possible cause has to be looked at and discarded to make sure there was genuine malpractice. It took our attorney a year to get to the point where he could tell us he really thought that there was a case. It took another year to get the hospital and doctors, attorneys, and insurance companies to get us information where we could finish the assessment. During the 2 years that we waited for this, I had to find another job because my boss didn't like the time I was taking off for Jerry's many appointments. And our company's insurance had skyrocketed because of Jerry's intense treatment. It was a small company. And I was told by both the insurance company and my boss that Jerry was the reason that insurance was going up. My new job was very understanding, and they had better insurance, but it was part-time because I just couldn't do full-time anymore. And on top of what the new and the better insurance company paid, my husband and I, on top of that, had to pay over $50,000 a year in medical costs ourselves. We had to refinance our house. We lost our savings. I went down to part-time work, and so did my husband. Our marriage suffered. My career was gone. And Jerry was still not that much better. We settled with the insurance companies for the hospital and the doctors a few days before we went to trial. I thought when they had originally asked for a settlement hearing, that they were, after 2 long years, ready to sit down and think about what it would be like to take care of Jerry. When we sat down, their initial offer was $20,000. The insurance companies then asked if we had Social Security and Medicaid for Jerry. We told them we could only get that if we committed him to a residence home. They suggested we find one. They then told us that our insurance would be adequate to meet Jerry's needs in the future and that everything else they would give us would be gravy. The insurance companies told us if we won a settlement in court that they would tie us up in appeals for years. We did settle after 2 really hard days of back and forth. They came up with what we had decided in advance we would need to take care of Jerry for life and to pay all the outstanding medical bills we had incurred. I'm not a politician. I'm just a person who's been through a lot. And my son will never be able to articulate the trials he's been through. But I want to say that I just can't see allowing legislation that might take deliberation out of the process. The only reason we got what we needed for Jerry was the insurance company's fear of facing a jury and the hospital and doctor's fear of publicity. The money we got for Jerry by law can only be used for his care, and it is being used for his care. If any legislation limits primarily to medical damages, who determines medical damages? Will it be the insurance company that offered us $20,000 or suggest that Jerry be put in a home or that the government pay for him? Or will it be the insurance company that I had in my first job that only offered $1,500 a year for all therapies, which we spend in a couple of weeks? Juries can decide if a person lives or dies, if a person's wrongly accused or can spend a lifetime in prison. I think juries can be trusted to decide what's right and wrong and how to correct those wrongs. Without that, we trust the future of people like Jerry to the sole discretion of insurance companies. Thank you so much for your attention today and for taking care of Jerry's interruptions.
Thank you, Ms. Brooks, and thank you for bringing Jerry to the table. Ms. Howard now, Mick, is that what we want to do?
Okay. Hi. I'm from Union, Oregon. In 1997, I was living in Portland. I've since then moved back to Union, where I was born and raised. In 1997, I graduated from college to be a medical assistant, and I began working at the Indian Health Clinic in Portland. I also gave birth to my youngest daughter in 1997, and due to complications after the birth of her, it was decided that I needed a hysterectomy. My insurance company refused to pay. The doctor added a bladder suspension, which was not really necessary, so that the insurance company would accept the surgery. I then underwent what was supposed to be a routine surgery. I awoke to a nightmare. Without my knowledge or consent, the doctor placed a medical device in my body while a representative from the manufacturer stood beside him telling him how. This device was not FDA approved and had not been thoroughly tested. I was the fourth in the United States to have this placed in my body. It has taken 6 years and 7 major surgeries to keep me from death's door. I have been left with irreparable damage and an uncertain future. Because of my illness, I was forced to give up a job that I loved and since then have not been able to work. While my husband had to miss many days of work to care for me, we watched helplessly as the bills piled up and we were forced to give up our house and our car and move back to Union so that we could receive help from family. For 6 years, I had to watch my children grow while I lie in my bed or that in a hospital bed, unable to participate in their lives. Insurance companies have too much control over our lives. What gives them the right to decide what is medically needed? Shouldn't that be between the doctor and the patient? Shouldn't the people in the medical field be held accountable just as the rest of society is? The way things are now make it hard to prove malpractice and put very little value on human life and the way it's lived. I thank God every day for the jury that was the hammer to make the insurance industry accountable for the pain caused my family. There's so much that I could say about what myself and my family have been through in the last 6 years. It's unknown whether I again will be able to work. I've lost 6 years from the time my youngest was a baby. I've had to have everybody else raise her while I watched that. Those are irreplaceable years that I can never get back. This issue is so important to the people in Oregon and the United States. We really need insurance reform. There are so many things we could change that would benefit the doctors and the patients and just in general all people. I'm not sure that I know where to start, but I know by putting a cap on malpractice suits is wrong. During my time and my illness, I've met many people that have been through many different things. To say that they're all worth $250,000 or less is wrong. Mine isn't the worst, but it's not the smallest thing that's happened. I thank you for your time and for letting me speak.
Thank you, Ms. Howard. Questions for any of the panel members? Representative Crummell?
Mr. Chair, thank you. I'm going to try to be very delicate about this question. The comment in your written comments here that it was without your consent. Do you mind telling us what kind of consent they did go through with you?
When the procedure was explained to me, I was told they were going to, besides the hysterectomy, after having 4 children, that my bladder had fallen somewhat and I had a slight incontinence problem. It was explained to me that they would lift it up and stitch it there. There was never any mention of any device or anything. That was what I was led to believe would happen. Going through the hospital records, there's a sheet that you sign if something is going to, they're going to use a medical device. It was checked, not applicable. There actually was no permission to use that device inside me.
Thank you.
Anything further? Okay. Thank you very much. We do appreciate you coming in and testifying to the committee.
Thank you for your time.
Mr. Rosenfield, come forward and has a presentation.
Sure.
Set up a few things.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Harvey Rosenfield. I'm the president of the Foundation for Taxpayer and Consumer Rights, which is a California-based citizen advocacy organization active in insurance, healthcare, and for the last 7 years, energy deregulation issues. I'm going to speak for about 15 minutes with your indulgence and then open up for what I would expect would be perhaps a lot of questions based on my presentation. First, let me say this. Would that we were here today discussing how we would, how we are going to stop the epidemic of medical malpractice that claims 100,000 American lives each year in hospitals alone. Unfortunately, instead, we are here because doctors say they cannot afford malpractice insurance coverage, even though for most doctors, malpractice coverage is a fraction of their annual operating revenue, somewhere between 3% and 5%, even though it's tax deductible. And even though all the malpractice payouts and premiums in the United States, in California, and I'm quite certain here, are a tiny fraction, less than 1% of the healthcare expenditures of this state or nation. Nevertheless, we're here because there is an insurance crisis, and I'm here to address it from California because we have tried all ways. We have tried everything, and we are the model. Unfortunately, we are the model for the proposal before you today, as MICRA, the 1975 Medical Injury Compensation Reform Act, is the model for President Bush's proposal to federalize malpractice lawsuit regulation. So let's go back to 1975. Interest rates are down as a result of the economy, and insurance companies begin to raise premiums. Doctors are particularly hard hit. In California, they start striking. They claim they are being driven out of practice. And Jerry Brown and the legislature, in an emergency session, pass MICRA, caps on damages and the other provisions of which you're familiar because they track, as I, my understanding, the legislation before you. Between 1975, when MICRA passed, and 1988, malpractice insurance premiums in California rose 450%. Now, the cap itself, other provisions took effect at various points, but the cap itself was upheld by the state Supreme Court in February of 1985. Between February of 85 and 1988, malpractice premiums rose 47%. You recall that was the second insurance crisis of the last 30 years. In California, it was auto, home, business, municipal liability coverage. During the period of MICRA, from 75 to 88, medical malpractice insurance companies paid out 31 cents of every dollar they collected. 31 cents went to victims. Well, the voters of California passed more tort reform in 1986 at the height of the crisis, as most states did. We were promised that if these reforms passed, that premiums for general liability and business liability coverage would go down. But they did not. And that's where I got involved. I did some research on this, and I determined that the insurance companies were the responsible for these crises, that they were not regulated, that they were exempt from the state's antitrust and consumer protection laws. So I drafted a proposal and put it before the voters in 1988. Proposition 103 froze all rates, auto, homeowner, business, medical malpractice, until for 1 year, until a 20% rate reduction was effectuated by all insurance companies, with the exception of life, health, disability, workers' comp. After the rollback was paid, Proposition 103 called for stringent regulation of the insurance company's profits, their expenses, their charitable donations, and most importantly, for our discussion today, their projections of future losses. It also mandated a repeal of the antitrust exemption that the industry enjoyed that allowed them to circulate pricing data among themselves. Applied for the first time the state's civil rights and consumer protection laws, created an elected insurance commissioner, and gave the public the right to challenge and intervene in a process to challenge rates and rate increases. Insurance companies spent $80 million trying to defeat Proposition 103. They put three of their own ballot measures on the ballot, which would have canceled 103 out and passed even more restrictions on the right of victims to go to court. Medical malpractice insurance companies were among those funding the opposition to Proposition 103. We spent $2.9 million, average donation, $10. Proposition 103 passed. All the insurance industry's initiatives failed. Proposition 103 delivered $1.2 billion in refunds to Californians. Contained in some of the materials I've handed out of the news clips, wouldn't you love to be able to show your constituents that you were able to provide them a $300 per person rate refund check? Of that $1.2 billion, $135 million in refund checks were issued to physicians. Now let me tell the committee. I've been in Florida, Texas, New York, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, and Washington, D.C. in the last 4 weeks having the same discussion. And in those states, lobbyists for the insurance industry and the medical association told the legislators that either 103 didn't pass, didn't apply to medical malpractice, or didn't result in any refunds. So I have brought in, some of it's been distributed to you, the proof, in case you need it, that the medical malpractice insurance companies paid $135 million back to doctors in California. Now, because of that, as this chart shows, premiums for medical malpractice went down 20.2% after Proposition 103 passed. If you adjust that for inflation, which we don't do because we don't want to mess with the numbers, we want to give you the pure numbers themselves, it would be actually a 30% reduction. Compare that to the 13 years of MICRA, up 450%. From 88 through 2001, malpractice premiums have gone down in California by 2%. How did they do this? The rate freeze, the prior approval system, stabilized the insurance process. One of the things it did, because it applies both to rate increases and decreases, you have to get approval either way, is stabilize and smooth out the dramatic fluctuations that are caused when insurance companies run into trouble in the economy, when, as is the case today, their investments do poorly, or as in the case today, when there's a double whammy. Interest rates are near zero, and the stock market's down tremendously, and there were significant investments by the industry in Enron and WorldCom by some insurance companies. 103 works because it controls the core problem of the economic cycle known as the insurance cycle, regulation. Tort reform, gentlemen, has never, ever lowered insurance premiums in this country. Just a few days ago in Washington State, they've admitted it. The insurance industry admitted that premiums would not go down. They admitted it before Congress when they testified in response to what I had to say. They're admitting it everywhere now. They will not lower insurance premiums. When they were required by a Florida law in the mid-80s crisis to quantify the savings of caps on damages for medical malpractice, they submitted filings, which you can easily obtain. I can provide it for you, to the Florida Insurance Department, saying that there would be little or no savings from tort reform. The only folks that benefit from tort reform, from MICRA, are insurance companies and those dangerous doctors who are not held fully accountable for their actions. Now let me tell you the flip side of this debate, the side that gets very little attention, unfortunately. Let me tell you about what MICRA has done in California. The caps on damages, the cap on attorney's fees, and the changing of the collateral source rule to require that taxpayer monies be paid first instead of to offset the cost of the malpractice. Those three things alone have done this, have prevented legitimate victims of medical malpractice from finding an attorney and going to court. And when you cut through all the rhetoric, gentlemen, that is what MICRA has done. It's not about fairness. It's not about lowering insurance premiums. What it's about is preventing people who are legitimate victims of medical malpractice. All but the most serious victims cannot get into court. They cannot find a lawyer to take their case. If you are a housewife, a homemaker, a senior citizen, a young child, a baby, you don't have enough economic damages to cover the cost of even bringing the suit with the caps on fees and awards. And, since I'm ashamed to say, California has also been a pioneer in for-profit HMO medicine. When you combine the bean counters at these HMO insurance companies with the restrictions on the right to go to court for medical malpractice victims, you fundamentally alter the formula, which instructs and informs the behavior of hospitals, doctors, and HMOs as to their accountability. In their cost-benefit analysis, they know how hard it is to find a lawyer and to bring a case under MICRA. And that is why MICRA has been such a devastating impact in California. People say, well, Harvey, what's your proof that you can't get a lawyer? That's a hard thing. We've tried to figure out how to quantify it. There's two things I will give you independently on that. One is that when asked by the New York Times recently, the Insurance Commissioner of California, who is a supporter of MICRA, said that he thought it was flawed, terribly flawed, because you cannot obtain a lawyer. Legitimate cases are not getting into court. But maybe the more persuasive information I can impart to you was provided in a 1994 congressional testimony by one of the most prestigious defense lawyers in California. His name is Robert Baker. He was summoned to Washington to talk about his view of MICRA. And since he was the insurance industry and the medical community's top lawyer for physicians in malpractice cases, everybody pretty much assumed where he'd come out. But he apparently felt that his duty as a lawyer, his ethical and moral obligation, was to tell the truth, and that was a higher duty than to his clients. And so he said, and I have the testimony and can provide it to you today, he said that he felt that MICRA had discouraged legitimate victims from going to court. So, in conclusion, I would say to this committee, as you deliberate on this issue, I would suggest that you follow the same instruction that should be governing what the medical society and the doctors throughout the country are doing. Unfortunately, it is not. And that instruction is, first, do no harm. Before you ponder or consider the enactment of restrictions on people's right to go to court, before you overturn hundreds of years of tradition in our country that allows juries to make decisions about personal responsibility, I would urge you to take a close look at California's Proposition 103 and at the insurance crisis we're facing today. Because what you're dealing with, and what a handful of physicians in this state, or perhaps more, but what a minority of physicians in specialties are really legitimately facing when they're confronted with premiums they can't afford, has nothing to do with and is no reflection of medical malpractice litigation. It is the reality that the insurance industry is able, without adequate regulation, to offset its losses in the marketplace with premium increases. And instead of just being honest and admitting that to all of us and saying, hey, that's what we're doing, they're scapegoating the legal system, as they have done three times in the last 30 years. As they tried to do after Proposition 103 passed. In 1992, there was a little bit of a dip because of the recession and several hurricanes. And they began to do the whole tort reform song and dance. But you know what? and it's contained in the testimony I've given you. The insurance industry executives realized that it had only been 6 years since the passage of Prop 103, and they were worried that if they did it so quickly, there'd be more Prop 103s in other states. And so they said, hey, we got hammered the last time. We better not pull one of these cycles this time. And so they chose not to. But here we are today, when they have made such an effort around the country to join up with doctors, having doctors in front of them to promote an attack on the rights of patients in this state and elsewhere. That concludes my prepared presentation, and I'd be glad to answer any questions about Proposition 103 or MICRA for the panel.
Further questions? Representative Crummell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I see on your chart there that starting again in 1998 or so, I'm trying to count dots and years and everything. Anyway, it appears as though in about 1998 or so, you've got, let me back up to about 1990, the rates have started to go up. They are almost to the point of where they were on at the passage of Prop 103. Now they've started to drop back down again, and it looks like they're going back up. Can you kind of explain that a little bit?
Sure. First, if you compare it to the national rates of growth, you'll see that the nation, in fact, there's a chart in the materials that shows this exactly. The nation's higher rate of growth, but more important, I think, for this discussion, the stability, the ups and downs. Prop 103 has, because it controls both increases and decreases, because insurance companies have to justify those. When at the trough of the insurance cycle, when interest rates are high as they were, or the stock market was doing great in the mid to late 90s, insurance companies want to pull in as much premium as they can to invest. They make most of their income is through investment of our premiums. They will sell any kind of policies at any price to the point of irresponsibility. That is what causes these tremendous gyrations, so that when the economy starts to fall or fail, they're stuck not only with reduced investment income, but also their poor underwriting decisions in the trough of the cycle comes back to haunt them. They start paying out more claims. This is an across-the-board phenomenon. It's not just medical malpractice. What Prop 103 has done by requiring them to comply with a regulatory formula that closely constrains their financial operations, it has stabilized the increase. It's still going up. There's no doubt about it. But it has not gone up as much as in other states where there is insufficient regulation. And as I said, the total between 88 and, as you point out, it's just about where it was back in 88. Whereas the rest of the country is way beyond where it was in 1988.
I see. Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Yes, follow up.
You made the comment that if the insurance companies were not exempted from the antitrust laws, both, and I guess it's mostly on the federal level, but helping a non-lawyer like myself understand how that's going to have an effect on premiums, how it's going to have effect on payouts, how it's going to have an effect on, life in general, I guess.
Well, there are two antitrust exemptions applicable. One is the federal antitrust exemption, and then there was the state antitrust exemptions that were enacted in the 40s as a result of a Supreme Court decision that said that implied that the antitrust laws, the federal antitrust laws, applied. The federal government, the Congress, legislatively abstained through its exemption, but allowed the states to make other decisions. Every state in the nation passed the antitrust exemption. Prop 103 repealed it. What's wrong with the exemption from the antitrust laws? Under it, insurance companies are allowed to literally circulate pricing information among themselves. I mean, no matter what your political, ideological persuasion, you would never countenance that kind of overt price fixing among any other industry. But what they were allowed to do and what they did do is to circulate all the data that would allow each company to understand what the recommended losses are going to, projected losses are going to be, the recommended losses, the recommended expense factors, the rate of return. In other words, it was easy to see what your competitors were doing. Now, we got rid of that in California with Prop 103. It's hard to quantify where that fits on this graph, but there's no doubt that by disabling that price-sharing mechanism, you stimulate competition in the industry. They have ways to figure it out, but it's a lot harder for them now.
Okay. Follow-up, if I may?
Yes, please.
Would you submit, then, that the medical community has sort of become exempted from the antitrust laws also with the advent of relative value units and how our Medicare system basically sets what is now considered to be customary and reasonable charges?
They're not, as far as I know, they're not exempted from the antitrust laws.
Well, no, you're right. They're not exempted. And so if one provider talks to another, if two orthopedic surgeons are talking, one says, what do you charge for a meniscectomy? And the other one says, well, I charge X. Then they're guilty of collusion.
Right.
But my question is that because now rates of reimbursement, rates of pay, basically, for providers are... is in essence regulated between the federal and state governments by the rates of reimbursement, and it's based on relative value units. Would you sort of say, would you agree that that's kind of a de facto exemption on the United States and states' antitrust laws?
No, I would answer, I don't see it as an exemption of the antitrust laws, but I do think it's a form of regulation. It's certainly a form of regulation. In fact, you've mentioned, I think one of the big problems, having been around the country, is these Medicare reimbursement rates and the state reimbursement rates are horrific. And that is, I think that's a real problem for practicing doctors, premium insurance premiums aside. So I would say that I'd say that they're regulated to that extent, yes.
Okay, I'm done for now.
Representative McPherson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Rosenfield, if I'm understanding this chart here, you mentioned it before that it was not inflation-adjusted. It looks like it is also not population-adjusted. It's total dollars spent, so that if in the 13 years from the peak that's illustrated at 1988 to the present, the end of that chart anyway, if the population of the state of California and of the physician community serving it has grown, as I'm surmising it has, that in fact then in comparison dollars, if both an inflation adjustment and a population adjustment, which would suggest that actually it's gone down in cost. Is that a correct understanding of the chart?
This is pure premiums taken in by the insurance companies. I've sort of referred to this a moment ago. We deliberately chose not to do anything to this chart because one of the problems that we've experienced nationwide is the blizzard of what I would consider to be manipulation of the data by the medical lobby and the insurance companies. So, for example, we talked about adjusting it for population, for say doctor population, so we could get an average premium for doctor. But in California, there's no way to know of the X number of doctors. Some of them are self-insured, i.e. they work for a big HMO Kaiser, a large, significant portion of the doctors. So they wouldn't show up as paying these premiums. And then there are doctors who are licensed to practice in California but don't. They might be in another state and they just have the license. Or there's some that are retired but maintain the license. And I cannot come before you in good faith and certify that. The actual... It wouldn't have much of an effect. We looked at it, and I actually tried to see if we had put it in here with some caveats in our materials, but it wouldn't have much effect. And I think this is the most honest data you can look at, most pure data, and it comports, actually, the 103 mandated a 20% rollback in all forms of insurance, and there you have it, 20.2. So I think it's pretty trustworthy data right there.
Thank you.
Further questions, Representative Anderson.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. You mentioned caps, and I think I understand pretty clearly from what you said about the caps placed on the doctor or on the non-economic damages. You also mentioned caps on the attorneys. Could you explain to me what caps have been put on through 103 or MICRA or any?
We have a sliding scale system of caps. That I don't have off the top of my head. Let me find them for you. Here they are. It's on page 29. I submitted to you my testimony before Congress recently. 40% of the first $50,000 recovered, 33 and a third of the next 50, 25% of the following 100, and 15% of any amount exceeding 200,000. And you know, there's no caps on the defense lawyers, and so on.
Again, what page was that?
I'm sorry, page 29 of the. Of the testimony dated February 27, 2003, with the picture of Jessica Santillan in the front. Page 29, under C, capping plaintiff attorney contingency fees.
Pagination.
Something's wrong. Oh, 31?
Of our.
Yeah,
31 of ours.
Really, I'm sorry. 31? Well, I apologize. In any case, is that under C?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes. And expenses for a case, where do those come from?
All come from what the victim gets. Everything.
So the victim pays the legal expenses.
Victim pays the attorney's fees, the court costs, which are very, very significant in a medical malpractice case. And if you, and in the testimony in the report that you have there, you'll see that insurance industry data shows that the insurance companies in California under MICRA fight these things. They spend an inordinate amount of money of every premium dollar on it, on their own attorney's fees to fight a malpractice case. So the cost to the plaintiff of prosecuting the malpractice case is that much more expensive in California. And all of it must come out of the victim's total recovery, which is why many attorneys in all but the most serious cases or involving the most wealthy will simply not take these cases.
Yes.
Are there any other expenses other than the attorney's fees and the award to the patient in a major case?
Well, they're the experts. Is that what you, are you, I mean, for expert witness fees and
would those not be
everything? Everything has to come out of the plaintiff's pocket. The expert witness fees, the deposition fees, the attorney's fees.
Are there court costs or anything?
Those are modest. I don't believe those are substantial. It's the cost of, you know, the discovery, prosecuting the claim. That is massive. I heard one attorney in California say, I read this, that they estimate the average cost can be $1 million for a serious case. I have no idea whether that's correct or not.
And that would include expert witness,
yes.
Attorney's fees,
yes.
State costs or reimbursement or whatever?
Well, the state costs, the way MICRA worked, it required the taxpayer-funded programs to cover part of the damage caused by the physician or hospital, the compensation. So that's a separate number. And under MICRA, ordinarily, in the ordinary system in most states for most cases, the governmental unit that paid out the compensation, the benefits to the injured victim, would then be allowed to go after the negligent wrongdoer to be reimbursed. The taxpayers would be reimbursed. Not under MICRA. MICRA prevents that from happening, and the cost is shifted, in effect. Part of the cost of the malpractice is shifted to the taxpayers, federal or state.
Okay. Further questions?
Mr. Roosevelt, I just had one question. We had some testimony yesterday from the insurance folks directly from Oregon. Have you had a chance to review the particulars of Oregon's insurance situation, its current rates, or any of that material?
I haven't. I would, you know, I'm not an actuary, but I would be glad to take a look at it and or find an actuary to take a look at it, because I think that's a good first step, is to have an independent assessment, not just of premiums and payouts. That data is relatively easy to get, but to look at the malpractice companies, either the doctor-owned or commercial companies, see how they're operating, and take a look. And then I don't know. I'm sorry to say I don't know not know much about the Oregon's regulatory structure. That would be another thing. I mean, I think, as we saw in California, we enacted extremely stringent regulation, but it's had an effect. That's what's lowered premiums. So you would have to. I'm quite confident saying this: Oregon does not have the Prop 103 style regulatory system. No other state does.
Are there any other questions? Oh yes, Representative Jensen.
I think we heard testimony. Yeah.
Oh, Representative Jensen, your mic.
I think we heard testimony yesterday in relationship to the industry's investments, that only some small portion, maybe 10 or 15%, were invested in equity stock sort of thing. The rest was in bonds. How does that correspond with your experience or what you've seen in California and other places?
We did a national study that concluded that there were hundreds of millions of dollars in the property casualty industry nationally, just from Enron, WorldCom. We also looked at, we were looking at, I think, auto insurance actually. And, you know, State Farm, the biggest auto insurer, had boosted by 30% its equity holdings in the mid-90s in order to cash in on what everybody tried to cash in on, which was that crazy market of that period. I cannot give you a definitive response to the companies doing business here, but I have been surprised to hear they're obviously very sensitive to this, because I've been seeing these the companies saying, oh, our investments have nothing to do with the fact that our premiums are... have to go up. And that's just a flat out false. To what extent Enron, WorldCom, and I know State Farm took a big hit from Enron. To what extent the companies here took that big hit, it's not hard to find out, but I just don't have that information on Oregon for you.
Follow up?
So I'd be reasonably safe to assume that if we had our 10 to 15% in Enron and WorldCom, that'd be a significant hit.
You bet. You bet.
Anything else? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Next on the list is Steve Brown. Is that right, Mick?
Yes.
Okay.
All right.
I thank you for allowing me to come before you today. It's an honor to sit before you and discuss this important issue. My name is Steve Brown. I'm 45 years old, and I reside with my family in Clackamas, Oregon. I have two daughters, ages 23 and 19, and I'm a victim of malpractice. Because of the negligence, I lost 90% of my vision. I'm totally blind in my left eye, and I have only 20% visual field remaining in my right. I know that one of the issues before you is the rights of the victims to go before a jury, to have the jury decide the value of their loss and of their life. And I know that's not an easy thing to do. I mean, how do you put a price on the loss of one's dignity, of their independence and self-sufficiency, and on their quality of life, let alone maybe their life itself? I know it's a complicated issue, and there's no easy solution, but I pray to God that the one thing that does not happen is that the rights of the victims are taken away. My story begins in 1994. I was diagnosed with a pituitary tumor. The pituitary gland is located at the base of the brain, behind the nose and the mouth. After discussing with doctors all the possibilities, it was determined that the best procedure would be what they call a transphenoidal procedure, which approaches the tumor from under the lip, the upper lip, and through the nasal cavity. I went in on a Wednesday, was in ICU, and out on a Friday, everything appeared to go perfect. I was told that that 90% of the tumor was removed, but it was later learned that only 10% of the tumor was removed. And then because of the fact that it was not a successful procedure, it was hidden from me, and was implied that everything was fine. In 1998, once again, I was having symptoms, effects of the tumor, and once again, it was suggested that I do a transphenoidal procedure, which was an incorrect choice, because the reason they couldn't get the tumor out the first time is because it was very fibrous and hard and could not be removed. So the other option was a craniotomy, and or what they could have done is a transphenoidal with my giving them permission to do an emergency craniotomy if there was a problem. I came out of surgery around noon. Everything appeared to be fine. I could see perfectly. Around 4 o'clock, there were signs of neurological problems. The nurses were checking me regularly. I didn't learn this till later on, but there were signs in the size of my pupils that something was going on there. By 6 o'clock, I had a headache, and I had asked for something to cure that. They gave me a Vicodin. My wife, who had gone to the hospital with me early in the morning, decided to go home and get some rest because we showed up there at 6 in the morning. By 8 o'clock, my headache was so severe I was on morphine and continued to be kept on morphine. At midnight, I started relaying to the nurses that my sight was graying and starting to disappear, and I continued to complain about that until at 2 o'clock, the nurses decided it was time to do something, and they were going to call somebody. I asked them to please call my physician, because I felt that he would be the person that would be most understanding of what was going on, and he helped me call my wife, and my wife came in. With all the terrible things that were going on, the worst thing and the scariest thing as I sat there and watched my sight disappear was that I did not see a doctor all night long. From 4 p.m., the day of my surgery, when there were first signs of neurological problems, not until 7 a.m. the next morning did the doctor come in to see me. And all I could do with all my pleading, my wife's pleading, is watch my sight disappear. And it was at 7 a.m. that the ENT, who had helped the neurosurgeon perform the surgery the day before, just happened to be on a routine check to see how I was doing and walked in to the chaos that he found and got on the horn to what I believe is my physician. My physician, my neurosurgeon, was not called until 7 a.m. that morning, even though I requested it at 2 in the morning. Although I went back to work temporarily with assistance, I lost my career that I invested 25 years into. I was employed with Burns Brothers Incorporated. I was the vice president of our restaurants, motels, and lounges. I oversaw 800 employees, 23 profit centers in 10 states. And I was in the transition of moving from the vice presidency to the presidency. I lost my career. How do you put a price on that? I lost my self-value, my daily feeling of accomplishment, and all the friends that surrounded me there. I lost my ability to play sports that I love so much, which not only was something that I love, but also helped me to maintain my physical fitness. I have gained 50 pounds since I lost my vision. the complications of my sight loss has resulted in the loss of my marriage. My children, who looked up to me with respect and admiration, started treating me like a child, and that was devastating. How do you put a price on these things? I mean, I can no longer drive. The loss of freedom and independence is gone. But with all those things, there are so many other things. I mean, everything people do every day has something to do with their sight, pretty much. Everything you do, from making lunch to going to the bathroom or enjoying the nature around you. I can no longer see the stars in the sky. I cannot see Mount Hood in the distance. And I may never be able to see the faces of my grandchildren. Okay? I carry this cane around. I'm not ashamed of it, but it shouldn't have had to happen. And regardless of whether I want it to or not, it changes people's perspectives on me, the way they see me. I've lost a great deal, and I know that it's hard to put a value on these things, but I can tell you it's far greater than $250,000. And I will close in just saying that I don't understand, I don't see why we are considering in penalizing the victims of malpractice, and I don't see why we are considering in rewarding those that inflict that upon the victims. And I guess the real problem is I can't see. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there questions for Mr. Brown? Okay, thank you, Mr. Brown. We appreciate you coming down to testify. Are you Ms. Heston?
I am.
Thank you for being here.
Thanks for your patience. I'm here today to tell you a little bit about what happened with my daughter, Michaela. That's Michaela sitting behind me with my husband. About 4 years ago, when Michaela was born, I was in labor for about 56 hours total. I was at home for the first portion of it, and they told me not to come in until my water broke. And 28 hours later, she was born. In the course of those 28 hours, several complications came up, and there were telltale signs that the pregnancy wasn't going properly, but the doctor told me that it was normal for your first pregnancy, that it would take a long time, and that, you know, I just needed to wait it out. And I wasn't doing too well physically. I was fairly ill when I went into labor, so I had a respiratory infection and had difficulty breathing, and whole numerous things were happening. What happened with Michaela, let me see if I can. Michaela was a normal baby when I walked into the hospital. She had no neurological damage whatsoever. And when she was born, she wasn't breathing. She was blue. It required, you know, resuscitation, life support for 2 full days. I wasn't able to hold my daughter till she was 4 days old because she was in such, like, critical condition in the NICU unit. And they told me basically that what happened with her is she had meconium aspiration during the delivery, and it had blocked her air passage while we were in labor. And they never determined that from her
monitor.
Right. And so they basically came in and said that she may not make it, prepare ourselves, you know, for the worst. She was very, very critically ill. And fortunately and miraculously, a couple days after she was in the NICU unit, she started to kind of make a turn for the better, and she started breathing on her own and wasn't needing to have the ventilator and that type of thing. And they gave her antibiotics. She had an infection. They released her 10 days later and told us that she had these tremors. They told us that that was from the shock of the delivery, and that she would probably have neurological damage. She was my first daughter, so I wasn't real sure what they meant by probable neurological damage. It was just kind of words on paper. So I started doing a little bit of investigation and found out what they meant to tell me is she probably would have cerebral palsy. And I advocated on her behalf for several months until I did get a diagnosis of cerebral palsy. But in that process, I lost my job. My husband lost his job. We lost our car. We wound up living in an apartment that was unsuitable to raise a child who had special needs. It was not big enough. It was not equipped for a handicapped, you know, child. We struggled pretty badly for the first, you know, 2 or 3 years. I was told by so many people when they heard my story that that I should go see an attorney, and so we did. And when we did, they spent a substantial amount of time trying to determine if it was a good case or whether or not something wrong had in fact been done. 4 months after I gave them the information, they finally decided to go ahead with the case. And we spent a good year later before we even filed for the lawsuit, and we really made sure that, you know, this was in fact what we wanted to do. The doctor made a mistake with Michaela, and she will never be able to do what normal children would be able to do. I don't know that there's a price that you could ever put on that. Certainly $250,000 isn't adequate. She has care daily that exceeds, probably, I couldn't even get into the numbers with you, but it's a tremendous amount of money to take care of a child with special needs. And to be able to project what she's going to have to go through for the rest of her life and the possibility that she could have just had a normal job and, taking care of her family, that's probably not going to happen. I believe that the insurance companies are trying to dictate and put us all in a box and put Michaela in this box where she is only worth this much to them. And she's worth a lot more than $250,000. Don't get me wrong. I'm not. But to say that each individual is just worth that, and that's it. And to not let the jury make that decision. The reason why we got what we got is because the insurance company realized if we went to jury, we would have won. Because there was a mistake made. She would be normal right now if the doctor had made better decisions during the course of our labor. So I guess I appeal to you that other people also who have serious injuries also get their day in court or get their opportunity to be able to offer their child a better quality of life or themselves for that matter if they've been injured. I know that that's what gives us peace of mind, and I suffered terribly after my daughter was born from anxiety, of worry of what would happen to her when I was gone, who would take care of her, you know, when she gets older, would she be able to go to college, does she have to have somebody with her to take care of her? I mean, there's things that you just can't even imagine that we think about day to day, that we worry about, and you can't put a number on that. You can't. Sorry. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Hespin. Are there questions for Ms. Hespin? Okay. Thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony.
Mm-hmm.
You can stay if you want.
Are you going to chat?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Well, we've heard from the people that matter. Now I have a few things to say. Yesterday I sat through the testimony of the doctors, and I was struck by the problem that they see and the dedication they have to their patients. And I was struck by also by the interrelationship between the doctors. Generalists rely upon specialists. Specialists rely upon subspecialists. The primary care physician in Reed Sport relies on the surgeon to conduct C-sections if there's a problem with deliveries. Neurosurgeons all over the state rely upon Dr. Wavy, I think is how she pronounced her name, a pediatric neurosurgeon in Portland. And all the doctors rely upon ER physicians such as Dr. Long, who are willing to work the odd hours that are necessary to deliver that emergency care. And the picture presented to me by the doctors, who I think are victimized by this crisis as well as the patients, where doctors working in an interrelated healthcare system and collectively sharing the responsibility of delivering healthcare to their patients. Collectively sharing that responsibility. They all need each other. The primary care physicians need the specialists need the primary care physicians. And as I listen to how they collectively share this responsibility, I again ask myself, why shouldn't they collectively share the risk? They all benefit from their various specialties. Why shouldn't they collectively share the risk? And the concept of the PLF, a fund that we have, of course, with lawyers, a fund that evenly distributes the risk among all professionals, again brought to mind, was brought to mind. It's evenly distributed rather than having either the clients, the patients, the victims, share disproportionately of the risk or have narrow specialists bear that risk disproportionately. It seems that the idea of sharing things equally is consistent with the shared responsibility that the doctors expressed yesterday, the shared responsibility that all the doctors had towards their patients, their willingness to work together, their need to work together, their need for one another. And when I've looked into this idea of a professional liability fund for doctors, I've gone through the numbers, and I'm not an actuary, and I'm not a mathematician, and my approach has been rather simplistic. I look at the number of claims and I look at number of doctors and I never get outrageous numbers. But I'm disturbed that I don't necessarily have that expertise, so I was listening very carefully to Ms. Robinson, I think, the actuary yesterday who testified on behalf of CNA, because she's the one who would understand these numbers and understand how these things work. And I listened very intently when she described how the insurance companies, rather than sharing their risks equally, share it very disproportionately among a number of classifications. We heard a neurosurgeon, or of neurosurgeons, who will perform surgery on the spine but not on the brain, because I guess that puts them in a higher risk group and increases their premium. But the numbers struck me much more. The numbers that she delivered, and I have her materials from yesterday, and at page 4, and she had a graph in front of you. She had a graph in front of you, and she said, note the progression of average cost from a lower risk specialty such as psychiatry, $1,200 per year, to a higher risk specialty such as neurosurgery, $39,000 a year. Then she pointed out that the bolded bar going across the chart at about $5,000 per year represents the average cost for all specialty groups combined, including the many other areas of practice not specifically shown on the graph. $5,000 per physician per year. And I listened very carefully to that testimony. And against this backdrop of what even sharing of the risk would produce, I listened also very carefully when Mr. Gallant said that his clients, the doctors of the Oregon Medical Association, would consider any remedy except one which merely redistributed the losses. Any remedy except for a professional liability fund. Any remedy except one which might result in $5,000 per physician per year. And I ask myself the question, why? I've asked myself that question since I've been on the task force. I've asked that question for the last 8 months. Is it because the lawyers are the messengers? I asked myself the question. And the only answer I got was again from the actuary. And the answer of why that's not an acceptable solution is because it's contrary to insurance principles. And on page 4, she says, consistent with standard actuarial practice, it is appropriate to recognize such disparate costs among different medical specialties and to reflect those cost differences in the premiums charged. Well, why? And she said at page 3, the grouping of risk with similar risk characteristics for the purposes of setting prices is a fundamental precept of any workable, private, voluntary insurance system. And I again compared it to the PLF, which is workable, which is kind of quasi-public, and which is mandatory, and which has been a success for lawyers. Maybe there's not a direct correlation between the PLF for lawyers and for doctors, but the risk spreading idea and the risk spreading and the risk sharing idea is identical. So I found out the reason, at least from the testimony, as why this approach is not appropriate. It's because it's contrary to insurance principles, not social principles, not health care principles, not to community principles, but to insurance principles. These are the same insurance principles that make a neurosurgeon work on the spine but not the brain because the classifications are so narrow. So our health care delivery system functions on insurance principles, not principles related to the collective delivery of care. And our legal system is asked to function on insurance principles rather than collective delivery of justice. And our legislative system, you gentlemen, are asked to function on insurance principles rather than the collective protection of the common good. And I think we can do better. And I listened to the anecdotes from the physicians, the stories that came up. Dr. Wolpat testified. I know Dr. Wolpat personally. I've dealt with Dr. Wolpat. I think he's a fine physician and, more importantly, what I would call a fine caregiver. And he testified that his group's insurance premiums tripled. And the only thing he could attribute it to was one claim involving a doctor no longer in his group and no longer practicing within the state. I hear of a surgeon in Roseburg who's charged $260,000 a year for premiums, and the story I said before that they related yesterday, neurosurgeons electing to do spine surgery but not brain surgery. With the actuarial numbers that were presented of $5,000 per year, I listen to those anecdotes, and I say, this sounds like an insurance system that's broken. It sounds like an insurance system that's broken. But that's never, ever what is heard. We heard testimony time after time again yesterday that the civil justice system is broken. The civil justice system is broken, not the insurance system, because the idea of allocation of risk evenly is absolutely an unacceptable potential solution. It's rejected out of hand. And why is the civil justice system broken? Well, one of the things that comes up is the Roseburg verdict, an indication that our system is broken. This was a woman late in her second pregnancy who reported to her doctor that the baby was not moving. She came into his office for a routine appointment, and he failed to apply a fetal monitor. And that started a downturn of events which ultimately led to a child born in extreme distress and suffering from cerebral palsy. And a claim was brought, properly supported by professional testimony, which, of course, is necessary. And there was a $2 million insurance policy. And the plaintiff's lawyer sought mediation, sought settlement to be paid the policy limits, not expose the doctor to any excess verdict, and the insurance company refused. Now, they may refuse for good reason, they may refuse for bad reason, and the resulting verdict was $8.5 million. But the lesson to be learned from that case is that the insurance company paid that excess amount. And they pay that excess amount only when their claims practices were unreasonable in handling the case. So the payment of over $6 million in excess was due to poor claims handling, an insurance error that cost each Northwest physician's insured almost $3,000 for the year on an insurance claims handling problem. And what we need is to take away the rights of people such as the baby in Roseburg, one with cerebral palsy, will have to live the rest of her life with that handicap. And then, and what's become interjected in recent discussions by Mr. Dorgan, and I like Mr. Dorgan, I was on the task force with him and we've spoken together in certain settings, that the Philip Morris case, the tobacco case, was an example of an Oregon jury, a jury of your constituents, apparently gone over the edge, that here is the precursor to what's going to happen in medical negligence cases. I think that Mr. Dorgan should have that discussion with Dr. Richard Schwartz, the widower of the woman who died, a local doctor who was a Northwest insured for a number of years before he retired, who watched his wife die, a terrible death from cancer after succumbing to the addiction of tobacco, an addiction that was concealed from the public. He might have that discussion with other doctors to see if they support the tobacco industry as those doctors treat thousands of patients afflicted with tobacco-related disease. He might have that discussion with the 12 jurors who listened to evidence for 6 weeks and returned a verdict awarding $50,000 in non-economic damages, $50,000 in non-economic damages, and assessed punitive damages of $150 million against a wrongdoer with immense wealth to discourage them from the type of misrepresentation that they have presented to the public. He might have the discussion with victims of crime who will see $90 million deposited in the Crime Victims Compensation Fund if the verdict is upheld. Those are the people that he should discuss this case with. And if those two cases are examples of the failure and the breakdown in the civil justice system, then so be it. I'll accept that criticism if it's of those two cases. Do those stories show that the civil justice system is broken or the insurance system? That's what you have to decide. And it was also presented that there's no cost to tort reform. I'm going to distribute to you the letters that people get to handle these cases from the Oregon Health Plan. The Oregon Health Plan and the dire financial straits that we find it today, who needs reimbursement for the funds that they expend for injured parties and seek reimbursement from these type of cases. That's the situation we find ourselves in. And in the last months, I have read so much and so many stories about the nature of the insurance crisis. I read a newspaper article about OBs who were protesting malpractice insurance rates had quadrupled. It was from the Paris, France paper. We all heard about the doctors in West Virginia who went on strike, a state with caps. The Missouri Insurance Commissioner undertook an extensive investigation of the rapid increase in premiums in his state, a state with caps. Doctors in Nevada went on to strike to force the legislature to pass tort reform to hear the next day that it would have no effect on insurance rates. I was distributed materials in the task force that compared premium rates in various states, and contrary to what Mr. Dorgan said, it showed that California's rates were higher than those in Oregon. So the evidence is that caps don't work either financially, and for heaven's sakes, they don't work morally. The task force articulated a mission to provide available, affordable, and stable medical liability coverage for the Oregon medical community while providing for patient safety and redress for those who are negligently harmed. There are solutions before you. There's tort reform, and there's an idea of a PLF. The PLF was a unique idea almost 30 years ago for lawyers and has been a unique success. You have the opportunity as Oregon legislators to again demonstrate that this state is different, that this state doesn't necessarily take a prepackaged group of legislation that has shown to have been a failure throughout the country and pass it because maybe it's the expedient thing to do. You can do something right. You can form a solution. And in 10 years, when the next insurance cycle comes around and insurance rates are going up all over the country, I think if you do what you can this session, that Dr. Bernardo, who testified, will have a discussion with a young lawyer, a young doctor who's thinking about coming to Salem to practice. And he'll tell the young doctor, Oregon's a wonderful place. It's a beautiful state. It's a great place to live and raise a family. I hope he says that it has good schools and a wonderful environment. And I want him to say that malpractice insurance is affordable because with a little prodding from the legislature in 2003, the doctors all got together and they said, we're going to collectively share the risk of medical errors. And we decided to take that step. And our medical negligence insurance is affordable and available and stable. And that's the story that I think can be told in 10 years when the next insurance cycle comes around. And you can do it, and I trust that you will. I appreciate the opportunity to testify before you, and I'll certainly respond to any questions that you might have.
Thank you, Mick. Are there questions for Mr. Alexander? Representative Crummell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you, Mr. Alexander, let's just say for a minute that you represented me in a case and I just won a $5 million settlement. Can you give me a breakdown of where that money's going to go?
Mr. Chair, Representative Crummell, it would depend upon what stage. If we went to trial and got a verdict, there would be a portion come out for fees. Normally would be a contingent fee.
Let's say we went to trial. Let's go ahead and say we went to trial and it was a jury that awarded the...
The fees, I would say, would normally be around a third of that recovery. The out-of-pocket costs that would be expended in a typical... There were some figures that we talked about in a typical medical negligence case. The rule of thumb that I use is that I would estimate that it would be a minimum of $50,000 in out-of-pocket costs to go to trial, and that may be a little bit low. Depending upon the complexity and the number of experts you had to call, it could well reach $100,000 in out-of-pocket costs. Those would come out, and the rest. And then there might be liens that would be paid off, health insurance liens, the liens from the Oregon Health Plan, and then the rest would go to the client.
So, if I may, Mr. Chair, follow
yes.
up. So out of $5 million, I can probably figure that I might see about three of it. And that's on a good day?
Mr. Chair, Representative Crummell, I think that's probably right. And that's one of the reasons why limitations and the idea that economic damages alone are going to make people whole is such a fallacy. Not only does it disregard the fact that pain and suffering and distress and what you heard from these people are very real, it may be hard to quantify, but they're real, but it also overlooks the reality of the cost necessary to process these cases. So that, in some respects, that's what enables these people to come out whole. When all is said and done, whole meaning just whole in an economic sense.
Okay. May I?
You may.
Sure. Now, if we were to form a PLF legislatively, and I thought I heard you say that the cost on a per position basis would be about $5,000. Am I correct in that?
Representative Williams, Representative Crummell, I'm not saying that's what it would take to form a PLF for medical doctors. I'm saying that's what historically was presented to you yesterday by the actuary. I think the cost would be more than that, and I wish that I had the expertise to tell you exactly how much it would be. I think that maybe we can gather some of that, and I think the insurance commissioner's office is in a position to try to gather that. I don't know what the capitalization costs are, what it takes to actually start one of these up. I know the PLF, I mean, I was talking to our director a number of months ago when it was kind of started on a shoestring, really, and kind of pay-as-you-go, buy some reinsurance and get it off the ground. You heard yesterday that the Northwest Physicians was started when, why did they say, 12 physicians took out a note for $1 million and capitalized it and started going. I wish I could tell you the exact numbers. All I know is that absolutely positively it's possible because it's been done and it works. And I wish I could respond, you know, to the fine numbers, but I just don't have that expertise.
Okay. And one more, if I may,
one
Mr.
More.
Chair. Since the government has kind of set the rates for medical providers and what they can charge. I mean, basically, that's what the de facto effect has been of Medicare and Medicaid and utilizing relative value units. Should we also set a cap on? I mean, if we were to create like a PLF, for example. Then should we set a maximum reimbursement or maximum amount that attorneys could charge so that when a recovery is made by a patient, the money actually goes to the patient as opposed to the money going to all of these other costs?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kummel, I think Mr. Rosenfield addressed that quite well. You know, the idea of caps on attorney's fees, and incidentally, I've handled medical malpractice cases, but if anyone thinks here that I've made a fortune off of them or will, they're crazy because I haven't done so. But the whole issue of attorney's fees is about access. For the insurance industry to say that they want more to go to the client by limiting attorney's fees is disingenuous at best. Defense costs are not capped. You heard about the difficulty with these cases. I can tell you there are not many lawyers in this state that will undertake a major medical negligence case because of the time involved, the expertise involved, and the expense involved. And as a business person, if you're looking at a very difficult case that are lost more often than they're won, and you want to put not only $50,000 to $100,000 of your own money, but an incredible expenditure of your time, which is all you have to offer to make your living off of, if you can't have the freedom to contract with your client, you're not going to do it. And more importantly, why on earth should that client not be able to hire someone as good as the defense can hire? They don't have any limitations. They have excellent attorneys. I have seen cases where the plaintiff brings in a couple of experts to testify, the defendant brings in a dozen, because the money is virtually unlimited. It's a high, if you just look at it from a business standpoint, it's a high risk, high investment undertaking that few people can do under the present fee situation. The client should have the freedom to go out and hire the best attorney that they can. And they restrict the fees. The idea that this is some charitable gesture by the insurance company is just false. It's about access. If you limit fees, the cases can't be brought, just like Mr. Rosenfield told you.
What if you restricted defense fees also?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kummel, I'd be real interested to see that legislation come forward.
Stand a snowball's chance in hell of passing, but, you know, it'd be interesting.
And the point is, both sides deserve good representation, in my opinion. Both sides deserve the best that they can muster. The playing field now, in terms of resources, is obviously uneven. Tilted towards the insurance companies, and that's not a gripe, it's a reality. I mean, do I have as much money as CNN? I mean, you know, that goes without saying.
Sure.
Do you want to tilt it more to favor them more? That's what it would do. Do you want to deny these folks who came in here and testified the opportunity to hire who they want? That's a decision you have to make.
Representative McPherson, then Representative Anderson.
Mr. Alexander, one of the themes that I've drawn out of some of the literature I've been provided and from some of the testimony here is the function of the medical malpractice system of providing a disincentive or an incentive for medical people, personnel, to be careful about what they do and to not undertake procedures they don't have appropriate expertise for or the proper equipment. And I wanted you to comment on how a system, a PLS-style system that would equalize the allocation of premiums would affect that aspect of the medical malpractice system. That is, would we be putting in place a or blunting the effect of that incentive for better medicine if we were to do so?
Mr. Chair, Representative McPherson.
It's an issue actually I've thought about, because they say, well, you're going to penalize these bad doctors. And there's a couple problems that I find with that. Number one, the premiums don't seem to go up because the doctor is a high risk. They just go up. And, in fact, in my discussion in the task force, I mean, I was really somewhat alarmed at it, even though the tort system is supposed to weed out people who aren't competent. But I don't know if Mr. Dorgan's here. I'm not meaning to pick on him. But I asked him, I said, you mean that you could have a physician, and I think the statistics are a physician will have 2.4 claims during the course of his career. I said, you could have a physician who's been in practice for 25 years, never had a claim, has a single claim, which is large because maybe they're an obstetrician, and then you cancel them? And he says, yeah. So the idea that if there was the response to the tort system by the insurance system, then maybe we would be losing something. I really think that the tort system can single out people who have multiple claims and demonstrate an inability to comply with a reasonable standard of care, and I think that they can be identified. Quite frankly, it's my personal opinion, I think that people like the Board of Medical Examiners need to do a much better job of policing, because the insurance companies don't really seem to police. Their cancellations aren't based upon lack of competence. Their cancellations may be based upon isolated claims or who knows. Why did they raise Dr. Wolpat's groups by triple? I have no idea. So I don't know that the insurance industry is really responsive to the potential deterrent effect, and it may well be that type of policing needs to be done by the licensing agency, the same way that the Oregon State Bar is pretty aggressive in pursuing lawyers, and the PLF is not very aggressive about. We do have a special underwriting assessment, which if you have claims, you have to pay a little bit extra, but I don't even know how effective that is. So I still think the tort system would identify problem physicians, but I'm not confident at all that the insurance industry responds in an appropriate fashion to identify an incompetent doctor as opposed to a good doctor who may have had a bad day. I don't know if that answered your question very well, but I think that the turn effect would be there, but it's not really there as well as it should be now, because the insurance companies don't seem to see the relationship.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Relating back to what Representative Krimmel was asking, I think I do see a parallel, but I don't think it's a very good parallel between the somehow limiting the fees that an attorney claims from a case that really do reduce the amount of dollars that the patient gets, and the you gave the illustration of the neurosurgeon or the trauma surgeon who gets up in the middle of the night for a trauma case, gives his very best expertise, and then runs the risk of losing everything he has. I don't see that on the attorney's side. You may lose a case, you may lose a fee, but you don't lose your whole personal wealth in a suit. And that's where I think the parallel ends. Can I follow up with another question?
You may.
Could you tell me how you see the PLF really being different and solving this problem? Because it would appear to me that you're creating a vast pot of gold that's a wonderful target for folks that want to sue that target.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, first let me respond a little bit to your first statement, I think. I don't know that there's parallelism in terms of fees and claims against doctors. I can handle, incidentally, I can handle the claim and I can have damages of $10 million that I'm claiming against a doctor, and I can mishandle that case and that becomes a $10 million claim against me. And believe me, that
destroys me personally as well. But I'm not trying to say that the risk I run is as great as the doctor. The realities are the doctors have very, very risky occupations, and that the patients sometimes, if they're not properly treated, are the real victims. But you have to understand, I think, and everyone has to understand, particularly maybe the people that aren't lawyers, that the doctors say, if I just make an error, I'm going to lose everything. Well, that's not true. The law is very clear about the nature of the standard that doctors are held to. And the doctors are held to the standard of a reasonable physician practicing in the same or a similar community. And that's really almost the exact quote from the jury instruction. So the doctor is held to a standard. Doctors are held to a standard that they set themselves. A reasonable standard for a doctor in the same or similar community. And in fact, the jury specifically told that physicians are not negligent merely because their efforts were unsuccessful. So although a bad outcome may certainly cause some sleepless nights, unless the doctor failed to exhibit a reasonable degree of skill and care, then the doctor is not going to be found negligent. And incidentally, in Oregon, I think juries don't find them negligent. As far as the pot of gold from a PLF, I think that the whole purpose of this discussion about tort reform is aimed towards providing reasonable and affordable medical insurance, liability insurance for doctors. Whether you call it a pot of gold or call it reasonable, affordable medical liability insurance is maybe just a difference in semantics, quite frankly. I don't think there's a pot of gold. I think that there are always going to be claims that are probably going to exceed the available limits when you have the tragedy such as which we've witnessed today. And I don't know that the PLF is going to be an ultimate solution to that, but I do know, at least I believe, that at least it will protect these specialists. It will protect the OBGYNs in rural Oregon who feel they can't deliver babies, and other specialists that see the type of increases that we have heard witness to in the last 2 days.
Representative, did you have another
question? Yes, one. And this might go better at the very end, but let me just ask it now. It appears to me that the OMA and the doctors are saying we won't accept a PLF, and you're saying you won't accept a cap on non-economic damages. Where are you willing to go in terms of the middle?
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, you know, that question's an interesting one because it's kind of like there's a solution that's a good one and there's a bad one, so I ought to accept a fair one, meaning fair average. In other words, if they come up with 10 things, all of which are bad, and I come up with one that's good, which two or three or four am I going to accept on their part? I think this is not a matter of what I'm willing to accept or what my group is willing to accept. I think the issue is whether or not there's a solution that's workable as opposed to a solution that just takes some rights away, doesn't do anything, denies people access to justice. I know every one of these bills, I think I could probably recite them almost, not by their numbers off the top of my head. There's nothing there that does anything but deny access or increase costs of litigation. Nothing there, other than caps, which is not really before you. All the bills, they present hurdles to litigants, they make the process more expensive, and they deny access to the court. Which one of those am I willing to accept? Which one of those bad things? You know, if it's something's forced upon me, I don't know. I don't think there's anything there that's constructive to the judicial system. And that's my honest opinion. I don't think there's anything there that is constructive to the judicial system. I think that a PLF model is something that is not only helpful to the judicial system, but to the medical profession, to our clients and their patients. And I'm not willing to say, well, I'll take this just because they want it. If they can demonstrate that it's something that's helpful, that's fine.
Oh,
yes.
Well, we're not really asking it. What I'm saying is that I think we're at a point where we're going to have to, this board is going to have to decide what's the last best offer, what's going to work best from your side, what's going to work best from their side. We're going to make the decision, not you.
Well, I know. You just asked me what I would accept. And I think the best solution for the doctors and patients of the state of Oregon are to try something new, something that's been tested in one area, meaning the lawyer's PLF, and to see if we can get something that actually works.
Thank you.
Representative Shetterly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Question maybe for Mick, but also for other members of the committee. I'm trying to think in terms of the PLF model. You mentioned the special underwriting assessment. I think that applies to an attorney who has had a claim. I wouldn't know. Except from what I read.
Boyd indicates he knows.
I'm running on the list.
Oh, okay, all right.
But also, aren't within the PLF, aren't there certain specialty areas where you pay an extra premium? It seems to me, for instance, securities, if you do securities, aren't there some special areas where you pay a boost if you practice in certain, I guess, what must be higher risk areas. So it's not entirely level. You've got that claims issue, and then it seems to me there are some specialty areas where you incur a special assessment if you have a certain percentage of your practice if you exceed a certain percentage of your practice. Does that sound familiar to you?
Mr. Chair, Representative Shetterly, I think there's something for securities.
What I've asked counsel to do is to check with Mr. Zeroff at the PLF and to give us just an answer about that.
I have one in the back of the room.
Is that right, Susan? Is it just securities?
I don't know that it's only securities, but definitely securities.
Okay. Well, counsel Joseph check with Mr. Zeroff and get us that list. Representative McPherson doesn't know either because he works at a firm like I do that somebody else just writes that check and you don't even bother to look. So was that your only question, Representative?
Well, it was, yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair, for now.
Okay. Representative Ackerman?
Yes, I think I have just maybe one question for Mr. Alexander, trying to figure out where the middle ground might be. What would be your reaction to rather than having a rush to judgment on either side of this, so putting this issue regarding the pooling of a risk among the physicians and or the PF model and funding a task force that would actually run some realistic models for us so we could see or at least test whether either of these ideas may have merit to compromise the or settle a controversy?
Mr. Chair, Representative Ackerman, now I think there's a lot of merit, and the task force that was put together this past summer really wasn't constituted in a fashion or with enough time or resources to do the sort of work that you'd want to see done. And I think it would be helpful. The one thing that we know is that even though everyone urgently wants something to give some relief immediately, there's no solutions that anyone says will give relief immediately, absent maybe the immediate institution of a PLF. Again, the actuary said the other day or yesterday that tort reform is not going to result in any immediate relief. So either you're going to have to look at something carefully that might, or you're going to have to take somewhat of a leap of faith, as occurred in whenever it was, 1975 or 77, when the PLF got started, and just figure that it's a sound concept, and if it can be capitalized, let's go do it, and then you can get a solution in process. But, you know, study might be appropriate as well.
Thank you.
Thank you. I'm sorry, Representative Prusansky.
Thank you. I just want to follow up and put a couple of things on the record regarding the contingency fees. I do not do personal injury work, but I used to be with a firm 20 years ago that did that type of work. And from what I understand as to the payouts that an attorney may see on a successful verdict at jury is a third at this point, approximately thereabouts.
Mr. Chair, Representative Prusansky, a third, 40% sometimes. I think Jerry Spence, probably all heard of Jerry Spence, I think he charges 50% flat, and he's worth it. But I think that the standard would be a third to 40%.
And if there is a settlement resolution prior to a jury trial,
what I remember was less than what was negotiated and contracted to for a successful result at that verdict.
Correct. The fee normally goes up for the extra effort and expenditure going to trial.
And you're assessing a case and taking on a contingency fee. If the cost of doing your preparation, your discovery, your expert work comes out to $50,000 to $100,000 and you are not successful at jury trial on a verdict or do not get a resolution pre-jury, who pays that cost?
Mr. Chair, Representative Present, you mean the cost of my efforts?
The $50,000 to $100,000 that went out for experts, discovery.
Well, normally what ends up is that I absorb that cost. The client is, as we know, responsible ethically under our rules for those costs. We also have the ethical ability to forgive those costs if the client is unable to pay. And you can almost imagine by definition that a client seriously enough injured in a medical negligence case is probably not going to have the ability to pay those costs when all is said and done. And so then we have the ability to forgive those costs of the client. And I would say that most my experience and most people I know, we absorb those costs. It's an out-of-pocket loss, and it's not insubstantial. And that's where I say there are not many people that can undertake these cases.
Okay. Further questions? We're about out of time. All right. Thank you, Mr. Alexander. Well, thank the committee for the presentation, sticking with us through the presentations today. And we're adjourned until tomorrow.